Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of August. Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld is our guest this hour. He is co-author of Hyperparenting, Are You Hurting Your Child by Trying Too Hard? And also The Overscheduled Child. He was a longtime member of the Stanford University Medical School faculty, where he headed its child psychiatry training program and headed a research project on typical families and how they teach sexual values and attitudes to their 2 to 10-year-old children. He returned to New York City in 84, spending time between the private practice of child and adult psychiatry in New York City, and he's also been an academic advisor to the Better Business Bureau's Children's Advertising Review, serving on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and associate psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and on the board of governors for Harvard Medical School's Center for Mental Health and Media. He has won many awards for his work, and we're going to be talking about this overscheduling, over-involved style of parenting, trying to keep our children from any kind of sadness in life, parents who are so determined to take the problems out of childhood that they never allow the child to develop coping skills. And psychiatrists have said that this can account for epidemics of depression, anxiety, binge drinking, and cutting themselves on college campuses these days. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many on this topic. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me with you today.
Yeah. I think that we do forget, and this is such a hard thing to do as a parent, is to allow your child to develop into this independent, competent, can cope with life human being. We want to protect them from sadness, from hurt, which is understandable, but a big job for us is to make sure they can function in the world, right?
Right, and I think also teaching them character. You know, what's so sad is that I think our generation of parents is trying enormously hard to do a job better than their parents did. And in many ways, we're succeeding. But unfortunately, as so often happens in our country, when we think a little is good or a moderate amount is good, we think a lot must be a lot better. Mm-hmm. We've learned what happens when we do that with software to our computer. We haven't yet figured it out with our kids all the time.
Mm-hmm. What does invasive parenting mean? What is hyperparenting?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think the term hyperparenting that we created was misunderstood because it was people thought it was we were talking about parents who were over the top, which isn't what we were doing. What we were talking about is a cultural pressure that I think has existed for the last 20, 25 years, which tells parents that if you want your child to be a success at life, you have to enroll them in every enrichment activity. You have to get them in every possible sport, music, learn Mandarin and Japanese, etc., and go from morning to night. And if you do so, your kid's going to get acceptance letters from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, MIT, University of Wisconsin, etc.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, and if you don't keep them going nonstop with enrichment, they're not going to measure up the competition. Their only acceptance letter is going to be a Sonoma State Junior College Knights Extension program.
Hmm.
They're going to be failures at life, and it's all your fault.
Hmm.
So given that cultural idea, given the idea, you know, in the old days, Dr. Spock was the only thing the last generation really read. And Dr. Spock started with the idea, you know more than you think you do.
Right,
which
yeah.
Which really bolstered moms to have self-confidence. In this generation, I think we're robbing moms, particularly, and dads as well, of the self-confidence. We're saying, I know how to raise a great kid, and you don't. And if you don't listen to me, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than bolstering people who are naturally anxious about being parents, we're undermining them.
Mm-hmm. How much of this drive to go to the best schools in the country is prevalent among parents? Is it just the very wealthy who are concerned about that? Is everybody concerned about that?
Well, I think different parents are concerned about different schools. You know, when people ask me, I say I'm a hyper-parent in partial recovery some weeks. You know, because the pressure's on me, too, and I'm an Ivy League junkie, and I'm not going to say I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether this idea of going to these And I think in less affluent areas, it's if your kid excels at sports, he's going to get an athletic scholarship or she'll get an athletic scholarship. So they'll have an opportunity to go to college that they might not otherwise have had.
Right.
So there's a lot of pressure on all levels of society, with the idea being that this way is your route to success.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some places where there's truth. I mean, if you went to Harvard or Yale, you probably did better, but you probably were a lot more ambitious and hardworking to start out with.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't think the data really supports the idea in full. And some of the people that I most admire didn't go to those schools and certainly didn't do that. I mean, what the story I love is of a young man who very much wanted to make films, applied to USC's, I believe, first film school and was rejected, so he went to Long Beach State. Tried very hard, and then he applied to UCLA's, or it was the other way around, I don't remember. Again, rejected. They said he wouldn't quite make it. He didn't have what it took. But he thought he did, and he tried really hard, and he did pretty well. His name's Steven Spielberg.
Oh, okay. I guess he did.
Yeah, I guess he did. And on the alternate side, you have another young man named George Gershwin, who had quite a career before he found music later in life, and his career was at his childhood hoodlum. Now, he was once asked, did you ever, you know, he must have played something as a kid. He said, yeah, only hooky. But there's this idea of a linear direction, you know, that if you don't stop playing hockey at four, you're never going to be any good.
Right.
I don't think it holds.
I know.
I don't think it's true.
And it's true with all these sports now. It's unbelievable. At the age of three or four, we got these. And I'm guilty of it, too. You know, I have
Me
my
too.
Son involved
I admit,
in soccer.
I admit.
Right.
In four-year-old soccer leagues.
Yeah. What's that all about?
Have you gone to the game?
Yes.
I'll tell you my experience. There are six kids on each side, four-year-olds. Two of them know how to kick the ball.
Right.
There are at least two picking dandelions. Two know how to kick the ball. And there's one kid who really kicks it terrifically.
Right.
But he's kicking it toward the wrong goal because they
don't
understand the rules of the game.
Right.
And there are 18 parents on the side screaming, no, that way, that way, that way.
I've been in games just like that.
I mean, we don't even appreciate anymore what an oxymoron the Little League World Series is.
Yeah.
Because the Little League was a wonderful idea started by a fellow who thought his nephews would really like to look like big leaguers. They could dress up in costumes. He got his company to make them, you know, outfits so they look like big leaguers, uniforms.
Yeah.
And that idea of every kid could play, they can imagine they're big leaguers,
right,
has turned into a professionalization of childhood.
Right.
And to me, that's a tragedy, because childhood is a preparation. It's not supposed to be a professional performance.
Right. Now, what about this idea? Let's take this, and how much of this is responsible for depression, anxiety, binge drinking, young people cutting themselves on college campuses, directly a result of this kind of pressure from age four?
I don't think we have the data as yet to support that, though I think it will be there. Not entirely. There are a lot of other pressures on kids. But I think that there are two things about it that make me think that there's some truth to it. I mean, there are three or four. Firstly, by the age of about, I think it's 12, Fred Eng at the National Association of Youth Sports would know this better, but I think he says that by the age of 12, 70% of kids have quit athletics because they can't play at that level. So they're already being told they're not good enough at that. If you're told most of your life that your value is for what you can accomplish, not for who you are as a person, how does it make you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Now, where did our idea of unconditional love go?
Right.
So I think that the pressure is not the only thing. It is part. But it's also the idea that I don't value you for who you are. I don't love you for who you are. I only value you for what you can accomplish and the award you can get me.
Right, right.
That, I think, is very demoralizing. It also gives kids a message that, you know, we say, oh, we all go through the books and tell us you have to bolster your children, make them feel good. So we say, oh, that's the best picture you ever drew. I never saw that. It's a bunch of scribbles and it isn't, but, you know, we're bolstering them for everything.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, they get the message implicitly. If I'm so good at everything, if I'm going to do so great, how come I need so much improvement?
Hmm.
So I must not be very good at all. And our anxiety and lack of faith in them, I think, often leads them to live down to our expectations.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that we want them to be the best at everything, that we're giving them all these classes? What need is that fulfilling for us as parents?
Well, I think, firstly, I think we are given the message through this hyper-parenting idea. that that's the way to be good parents. We're trying very hard to be good parents.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think as we look at the world, it's becoming a one world economically.
Yeah.
And we know we're competing against a lot of countries, and we don't know if our kids are going to be able to make it into the same economic and social situation we're in, and we're anxious about it.
Right.
So I think that what it really boils down to is that we're very frightened as parents, we're very anxious as parents, and we're trying to do the things that we're told and we think are really going to help our kid have a chance at success.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all for the good. I just think that we're being given some improper information and often are being led down the wrong road, sometimes for commercial reasons.
Mm. I remember the story. I can't remember where FDR went to school, but I remember the story of his mother moving into an apartment building right down the street from where he was going to school. And there, I had two responses. I thought, oh, God, good for her. She could be right next to her son and see him and help him out. And the other was, wooey, could I possibly be that kind of parent myself? And wouldn't I want to have an apartment down the street for my son to make sure he was doing okay?
Well, there was some stories about FDR, if I remember correctly, that when he was president, he occasionally would hear a clerk say, "Mother, please get off the phone." And, you know, this is a very exceptional family, you know, with the
right.
Roosevelt sort of owned a good part of New York State in the 19th century. So old Dutch wealthy families were a different group.
Yeah.
But she was sure and true to be married, his cousin, fifth cousin, whatever.
Yeah, really.
You know, it was a different world.
Right.
But most parents of that generation, and I know someone of similar stature, next generation, who said to his mom, "Mom, remember my name? I'm out." Yeah, because the parents often, and certainly in very wealthy families, would send the kids off to Swiss boarding schools or
mm-hmm.
in England to boarding schools at the age of seven.
Right.
The parent involvement in child rearing was rather slim.
Mm-hmm.
So Mrs. Roosevelt was an exception in
yeah.
her intrusiveness.
She sure was. So how do you, this is the question, and we need maybe more on this, is how do you raise a child? Because we do ultimately want our children to make their way in the world, and it's a hard world. The economy is not very good. It's very competitive. We want them to be fulfilled human beings doing work that they love. I don't care how much money it pays. But how do we develop that kind of independence in them? We need more information on that, I think.
Well, I think there are several ways I can address that. And I do care how much money they make, because I'd like them to be able to afford some of the things they want to buy in life. And when you're struggling to make ends meet, it isn't fun. So I'd like them to make sufficient money so they can afford something of the lifestyle they would like. Secondly, I think that we also have to pressure our kids some, because it's their responsibility. This country is so generous to us. We have, if you think about how many cars did your grandparents have, or how many you, how many television, we live so affluently. The country is so generous to us. I think we owe giving back. Now, it's not for me to tell my children how they should give back. That's their creation. That's how they have to build their lives themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they have to feel an obligation from me to pay back
mm-hmm.
for what they've received. So how do we raise kids, I think, who are a little bit more confident? I think the fundamental is to control our anxiety.
Hmm.
Because I think, in my experience as a child psychiatrist, if I see parents who have a confidence that their kid is going to do okay in life, they're going to do fine, that feeling suffuses itself into the kid's bones.
Hmm.
And they feel an inner confidence that encourages, ups the odds of them succeeding at life. Secondly, I think that we do have to get education, and because I think that is the way forward. If we look at all the economic suggestions,
sure.
innovation and creativity. So where do we get innovation and creativity? Innovation and creativity come out of boredom. They come out of our letting our kids have some time to think for themselves, to imagine for themselves, to create a new world themselves. They come out of schools which make them, where there's never a wrong answer, there's an interesting answer. How did you come to that? So we have to think about our educational system and how we encourage innovation and thinking within it, rather than rote, you know, George Bush-style educational policy.
Mm-hmm.
We have to think how to encourage relationships rather than just accomplishments? Because everything I've seen is what makes the difference to make a good life and a bad life is the relationships you have. As a friend of mine, on his fourth marriage, said to me, well, you know, if you have enough good relationships, money does, it helps you to be miserable in much nicer surroundings. I'd like my kid to be in nicer surroundings, but I don't want him to be miserable.
Right.
So I have to form the relationships, and those form out of the way we relate to each other as a family. And each family is unique. But if we're frazzled, if we're harried, if mom and dad are rushing and feel like with their college degrees they've been degraded into being chauffeurs,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't encourage mutual respect and warmth.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth, I think that the marriage in married couples is the central phenomenon for our children's security and success. So if we want our children to have more successful, happier lives, we have to live a life in a family with balance, where everybody gets something. It's not all for you and none for me.
Mm-hmm.
With the measure of my motherhood or fatherhood is not how much I sacrifice. But I also think we have to attend not just to rearing our children and sacrificing, which we all do if we're good parents, but we also have to attend to our marriage. So I've said the best advice I can give you if you want your kid to have a happy, successful life is to have more fun in bed.
That's the answer. I didn't expect that answer.
I got you.
you got me on that.
But you see, it's metaphorical and literal. Because if you feel somehow satisfied as a parent, if you feel you're getting something out of life, and we all get something out of nurturing our kids, seeing them grow, watching them accomplish, teaching them, playing with them, but if you feel your life is also fulfilling beyond that, you have a lot more to give.
Right.
And it's a very demanding job we have as parents.
Oh.
It changes in its nature as the kids get older.
It does.
It's incredibly demanding. It takes a lot of tightrope walking.
Yeah.
And to have the energy for the job, the good humor to not get irritated all the time,
mm-hmm.
and the balance to not fall off the tightrope takes a sense of inner ease.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not happy in your own life, you're going to take it out on your kids. You're not going to feel at ease.
Yeah. Phone calls. We'll welcome him. Our guest is Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld. He's co-author of Hyperparenting, Are You Hurting Your Child by Trying Too Hard? He's also the author of The Overscheduled Child. He has written all kinds of professional articles on child abuse, sexual rearing styles, psychotherapy, foster care, and historical issues. He's written a number of other books, and we're welcoming phone calls on, we've already talked about what it's about, hyperparenting and how you go about raising a child who can maneuver the world, him or herself, and be successful and give back and have enough money to be able to be somewhat comfortable, not have to worry about being poor. What about all of these? And you know, what epitomizes all of this to me is to watch the Olympics when you've got these young girls who are particularly, I think it's evident in the gymnastics competition, where you think their whole lives have been gymnastics. And look at how the Chinese have special schools where some children who have nothing else in life are at least able to have a life, but it's all gymnastics all the time. All that training, all of that, I don't know about it. I'd love to watch it, but I don't know about it to raise a child in that kind of environment. But here we are, soccer games at age 4, gymnastics at age 5, Little League, very competitive, and as I didn't realize that 70% quit by the age of 12, athletics. That's quite something, because we're invested in that as parents, don't you think? So how do you get your children ready to fly, to move out on their own, and let them have good lives? Well, here's our number. Join us, please. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, please ring 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest, Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld, will take calls for him in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls now for Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. And we go to Walt from Spring Green for our first call. Hi, Walt.
Good morning. Thanks for a wonderful program.
You're welcome.
My first question, I have two quick questions. My first question is, has Dr. seen any relationship or research done out there on family performance and academic performance for kids in this generation regarding homeschooling?
In answer to the first question, I don't know the data right offhand, but I think the results for homeschooling are excellent. You know, it's the big dirty secret, which many of the public schools don't want you to know, is about kids who are homeschooled do very well, and I gather, and I'm not part of the movement, but I gather that some of the serious social problems that people spoke about 10 and 15 years ago have really been solved through certain groups and other involvements. So I think those kids are doing better, but it's very hard to ascertain. People who homeschool their kids are often a particular group. They're often bright, educated, etc. So, you know, what the variables are and how it is, I don't know, but I don't think, despite what people like to think, that the data indicates any bad outcome.
What do you think about it, Walt?
Well, personal experience. I have four children, two in high school, two now in one in elementary, one in junior high. We homeschooled them all until about the age of 11, and they did so exceedingly well that when we put them in the public school system, that's when the family problems started.
Well, I think
sixth and seventh grade, because they were so far ahead of their peer group, that's kind of backlashed into the family environment. And kind of oddly enough, that's where it began.
Hmm. May I comment on that for a moment?
Oh, please.
Yeah, you see, I think that there are two parts to that. I don't know if there are any social issues involved, but what you're saying is what public schools need to hear, that they are really doing such a poor job that homeschooling can far exceed what they're accomplishing. And I think that we could do far better in our educational system if we, one, paid attention to what the homeschooling people are saying. And frankly, I know this isn't politically correct, but looking forward, looking at what some of the alternative schools and the charter schools like are doing, where you have some schools, let's say in New Haven, Amistad, which is showing kids who are two grades behind when they stop from indigent families, and after several years, they're 2 years ahead in reading. Suppose it couldn't be done, but it can be done. And our educational system needs drastic reform, because we're still based on an educational system rooted in preparing kids for a factory economy of 1900, not for an information economy of 2008.
Yes. I'm sorry I interrupted you there, but I was going to say I work in Washington, D.C. part-time and live in Wisconsin, and no one in the District of Columbia that I personally know, mainly white-collar professionals, send their children to the public school system.
No, because you know.
Called charter or private schools.
Hmm. Of course, because you know.
The other question, sir, I had for you, wonderful answers and thoughtful insights. The other question I had was, you mentioned earlier about you coined George Bush standards and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what you see as far as the influence on parenting and, again, academics with kids, and having the third parent or the second parent, the public school system, sort of interacting with this and saying, kids need to meet a certain standard. But yet we're not comparing to, say, World Health Organization math test exams. We're about, like, 30th now in the world Indonesia, Japan, where we were, like, number three about 10 years ago.
Well, you know, I don't want to take a political position on this, but what I meant to say is that No Child Left Behind, I think, has not been a successful program. Certainly children need to have the basic skills of addition, subtraction, multiplication, etc., you know, learning how to write, things like that, and express themselves. However, for the kids in the future, so emphasizing getting these skills is important. However, for the future, kids also need to think independently, and I think these standards, particularly in somewhat more affluent districts, are encouraging teaching for the test, not teaching for novel thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need is novel thinking.
Thank you so much, Walt, for your call. Let's go to Mary Lou from Minocqua. Hi, Mary Lou.
Good morning. You were talking previously about raising children to be independent adults, and that was always my goal as a mother. I just wanted to make sure that my kids weren't the ones that stayed at home and never really flew the coop. But it's very, very difficult to do. It's harder to have the goal of raising independent adults than to not have that as a specific goal. I remember when my oldest went to kindergarten the first time, I made sure he got on the school bus himself. It was a lot easier for mom to put him in the car and drive him there. I thought, there are steps he has to learn. Now, that's to say I didn't follow the school bus to make sure he got off and got into his class, all right. But yeah. Things like that you have to do. It's harder. I didn't send. Two of my sons, who are all now in their 20s and doing really well, two of them chose to be exchange students in their high school years. Now, I had a lot of raised eyebrows from my friends and peers who said, what kind of a mother would allow her child to be gone for a year? And I said, I'm going to miss them terribly. But it's an awesome opportunity and a way for them to grow up and experience the world. I love them enough to let them experience it that way. But a lot of the parents I knew couldn't understand that at all.
Well, I have so many things I want to say, and I don't know where to start. First of all, in terms of high school and sending kids overseas, you know, the upper crust has always sent kids to boarding schools after 8th or 9th grade in America. So this is hardly a new idea, and they seem to have done pretty well for a number of centuries. Secondly, how do you raise independent kids? I think the world has changed dramatically, and when you get independent to be an adult today has changed dramatically. You know, the story of when is a Jewish fetus viable? Do you know?
No.
When it finishes medical school.
So, yeah.
So and as I see it, kids are not hitting their stride till their 30s today. They just aren't. And it's not surprising, since they're going to be in the workforce probably till in their 70s. And we need far more sets of experiences and novel experiences to come into the workforce if we're to lead technologically and with ideas. And I'm talking about more upper middle class kids. So I don't think that's unusual. But the art of parenting from the moment of birth is how to slowly separate at a rate a child can tolerate and to foster independence at a rate a child can accomplish. And every kid differs in that. But it's an art. When you wean your child, you fostered independence. When you birth your child, you fostered independence. But when you let them walk away from you and come back, you fostered independence. And it's how to do that artfully so they don't get too scared and feel abandoned, and yet that you've given them the inner confidence, I can do this,
right.
But I can come back if I get scared.
I think too many parents just are not appreciating the fact that from the moment you give birth, your job is to raise them and let them go. You have to let the birds fly.
But you have to first make them feel safe, secure, loved, rooted in their hearth and in their home. And then the greatest sacrifice you have to make as a parent is to take this person you probably love more than anyone in the world and to let him break up with you. So you've done all that work
right.
for someone else's, their spouse's advantage.
Right. That's quite a way of looking at it, isn't it?
It is a more generational way, because it's not just for their advantage, it's for the long-term interest of your family.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've raised them well and they select a spouse well, they'll raise more healthy kids,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be to the advantage of your family long-term.
Yeah.
But that is our job.
Right.
That the person we love so totally deeply and
right.
we would step in front of a truck for
right.
is going to break up with us.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, Mary Lou, for the call. We have lines open if you want to join us, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050.
You know, I wanted to, if you have a moment, to say just a word about your comment about the Olympics and a couple of things.
Yes, please.
Firstly, you know, you can't but be moved to see Michael Phelps go up there and get the gold.
Oh, I know. I'm watching every moment.
And you just can't but be touched. However, what we don't appreciate in this going for the gold mentality is that most people don't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't make it.
Yeah.
I gave a talk to the National Association of Youth Sports, and a woman came up to me afterwards and said, thank you so much for giving that. You know, I was a champion gymnast.
Hmm.
I was cut. I was the last person cut from the Olympic team. I was the seventh. They only took six. Shit. At 30, I had both of my shoulders replaced.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you for letting people know what this does to a body. I have a very good friend who's an Olympian, a champion, Donna De Verona, won two golds, I think, in the 1960 Olympics, and is a wonderful woman and a great champion of the Olympics. But her contention is that we need doctors and lawyers and businessmen and creators and inventors far more, and that athletics is wonderful, but it's a means. Mm-hmm. And we need families. So she insisted, even though her kid was kids were wonderful athletes, that they have family dinners together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was also struck by the Chinese. I don't know if you saw that bit on the way that they train their gymnasts. And it's a different thing because they're taking in some young people who've lost their parents or the results of a married man having an affair, and so there are they don't have homes. So they've brought them into these gymnastic settings, really little kids who can do these enormous things. They just astound, well, gymnastics astounds me anyhow. I can't believe the body can do this. But what a different way.
It can't over time. It's incredibly destructive.
Right. Yeah. But a whole different way of giving them a home. Giving them a home and a purpose, and the purpose is you be a great gymnast. You do this with perfection.
It's very hard to accurately comment on the politics of a country and to decide whether you're seeing a country emerge from a dark past or whether we're watching a gala Berlin 1936.
Hmm.
It's very troubling to some people and very encouraging to others.
Mm-hmm.
And the Olympian ideal of striving for excellence is a lovely ideal.
Mm-hmm.
However, what if you're only sort of really very, very good? I mean, is everybody who works for Microsoft the best? Have we done away with the bell curve?
Right.
You know, most of us are average.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's one thing we do well.
Mm-hmm.
But the tragedy is if you look at the history of the Olympians, you know, what happened to these black athletes? Necessary Jesse Owens, who did pretty well, though he had pretty rough times. What happened to that Wilma Rudolph team? What happened to all those great black athletes after the athletics? They worked as janitors.
Gee.
You know, so, yes, and to win gold at the Olympics is wonderful, but it's the beginning of a life, not an end.
Right, right. All right, let's go to Frank from Sheboygan. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would like to respond to the other caller who spoke about homeschooling. I'm a retired teacher, just recently retired. I've been teaching music in the Sheboygan schools for 30-plus years, and I traveled between schools. I saw a variety of teachers and a variety of school climates, and I can honestly say here in Sheboygan, we have good schools, excellent schools. Every teacher cares. Every teacher tries. And if there is a disparity between what homeschoolers can accomplish, I think you should possibly factor in this one thing. Student-teacher ratio at home is what? 1-to-1, 1-to-2, 1-to-3. And if you gave the same teacher-student ratio to the public schools, we'd accomplish very remarkable things, too. Remember, in that classroom of 20 kids or so, you could be functioning as a very fine teacher, classes with you, and in the corner there's some student who is not with you, is languishing. It's nothing that you've done. It's something that's happened on the playground, on the way to school, or sadly at home. There's so many factors involved. And yes, homeschooling accomplishes wonderful things, but let's compare apples to oranges, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I think there's a lot of truth to what you say. Unfortunately, I wish that the ratio was 20-to-1 at some of the schools I know in the Bronx, which can have a ratio of 36-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
And in that kind of situation, who do you pay attention to other than this disruptive kid? You have no choice. I do think though, and I agree with a lot of what Frank said, but I do disagree with the idea that even if you have wonderful teachers, I think the way curriculums have been designed are ancient. I think we have to have a real rethinking of curricular design and a real different approach to the indigent and failing kids. And if you look at, let's say, in our area, in very affluent communities like Scarsdale, we have a community that has to back out because they can't do an No Child Left Behind curriculum with these excellent students.
Mm-hmm.
So there are terrible problems, I think, in the way we educate because we have a one-size-fits-all. I think, and this is it's not my expertise, but I do think that we have two very different ways we need to educate children, and it's based on family structure, not on social status. Kids who come from very well-organized families that are very coherent, who have well-integrated personalities, need a system of education that stimulates them to think out of the box, that gives them considerable freedom, that relies on their own internal structure to allow them to be self-disciplined in the classroom. There's another group of kids who come from more chaotic backgrounds and less organized who need a more structured classroom to build internal structure. But you can't do that in a public school system.
And thanks, Frank, for the call. We need to pause for a moment. We'll return. Hyperactive parenting is the subject this hour and a lot of other issues as well. Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld is our guest. He is the co-author of Hyperparenting, Are You Hurting Your Child by Trying Too Hard? Also author of The Overscheduled Child. He was at the Stanford University Medical School's faculty for a number of years where he headed the Child Psychiatry Training Program. He has been in New York in the practice of child and adult psychiatry, and he has also served on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, associate psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and has written widely on a number of issues important to our times. I'm Kathleen Dunn. The number 800-486-8655. One line is open, and the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Diana from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Diana.
Hi there, Kathleen. I'm having so much fun listening to this discussion, and there are so many threads I'd like to follow, but here's the one I'd like to ask Dr. Rosenfeld. I'm interested to know if he's heard of the little vignette that's been floating around the Internet called, and I'll say it as clearly as I can, Shift Happens, S-H-I-F-T, Shift Happens. And it's a seven-minute vignette about education, and I was introduced to this clip through my child's school to discuss as parents, are we educating our children to have the tools they need for the jobs they will be filling that haven't even been created yet? So I was just curious about if the doctor had actually been exposed to that.
No, I'd love to see it. I've never even heard of it. You know, if you go to my website, hyperparenting.com, you can send me an email with it. I'd love to see it.
Happy to.
Where is it? Where do you find it, Diana?
You can Google Shift Happens. And it's, again, a seven-minute clip, and it talks about what's, you know, it talks about the world economy, and it talks about, you know, that our children will have seven different jobs in their lifetimes. You know, they won't work for one employer for 30 years kind of thing. And it's incredibly informative, educational, and it gets your mind thinking forward, because I so concur with Dr. Rosenfeld about that we are not, our current educational system is incredibly lacking in terms of providing our kids with the tools they're going to need. So I think your listeners would be very interested and simple. Google it, and it should come right up.
Great. Thanks, Diana.
Now, Diana, in a funny way, I think that what has made America unique, and it's really not our obedience, it's not our following, it's that we have rebels. We're a country that doesn't necessarily always respect the elder generation. Somebody comes along, whether it's a Bill Gates or a Michael Dell or an Alexander Graham Bell or whoever, who says, I just think I have a better idea. And that's where we are different than a lot of other countries where it's very hard to resist an older generation. We've been open to innovation. And that's what we have to continue to be open to because that's what's made for our economic success. That and enormous natural resources.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call, Diana. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to William from Madison. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Fine, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I appreciate your show today. It's actually touched on quite a few topics that I've been bringing up with friends and relatives lately, and the main thing I really want to touch on is that personal accountability has been something that I think has been kind of being brushed to the side with my generation. I was born in 81, and I think a lot of my friends haven't been given the tool of, well, really just being accountable for all their actions and what they do. A lot of things have been blamed on other parts of society. You know, a lot of times when you see things in the media where someone makes a choice that goes against society, like a murder or a robbery or something like that, they always try to find different sources to point a finger at instead of at that person and the choice that they made. And I think that's one thing that parents really need to keep in the forefront of their teachings to their children, is not only, you know, be a good, you know, worker, be a good friend, a son, a daughter, a father, but, you know, always know that you're responsible for the actions that you take in life. And I really think that in my school that wasn't taught as much, and because of that I was kind of considered to be an outsider because I always questioned authority, I always questioned the teachings that were given to me, and I always had different thoughts, like the doctor was speaking about. You know, there's different people that don't always follow such a linear path, and when they do that, they have to be accountable for the, you know, choices that they make. And for me, that ended up with me leaving high school and actually going to get my HSED in about a month versus waiting, you know, another year to actually graduate. And my school just really wasn't sympathetic, and they didn't really understand where I was coming from. And I was just kind of sad because if nurtured correctly, I could have had a lot more opportunities provided to me, but I wasn't.
Can I mention, William, can I interrupt you and mention two other kids like you?
Sure.
There was a kid who went to high school, was told he wouldn't amount to anything. The advisor told him he was at most a junior college kind of kid, so he enrolled in the junior college and worked as a firefighter to earn a living because he was from a poor family. And in junior college, it was a history professor who really turned him on. He started to work. He transferred to regular college. His name is Brian Williams, the NBC.
Oh, really? I didn't
you
know
bet.
That.
You bet. He was a junior college boy. There was another kid in Germany. Very similar. He was told he didn't speak till he was five. He wasn't going to amount to anything. His headmaster said he wasn't going to be of any good. His parents, thinking otherwise, sent him to a Swiss school that was very progressive and had different ideas about education. And his name's Albert Einstein.
Right.
So we do need very different approaches. However, the idea of taking personal responsibility, I'll feel a lot more comfortable about individuals taking personal responsibility when I see our politicians doing the same.
Mm-hmm. Right. William, thanks for the call. Let's go to Wendy from...
You know, I'm not just making a joke. It all starts at the top.
Right.
When we have a nation where our leaders don't take responsibilities for their actions, where they deny that a $500 billion deficit is their responsibility, where they deny that they're responsible for affairs, where all that occurs, how could you expect an ordinary citizen to take responsibility? And one of the things that we talk about in our book, The Overscheduled Child, is how critical it is and how parents need to teach their children character and how they do it. And character is saying, I made the choice, I'm responsible.
Right. Let's go to Wendy from Eau Claire. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. This has been such a great show to listen to. I happen to be a single mom of two little girls who, of course, I feel are brilliant. But I've made a real concerted effort to not put them in everything. Well, my youngest is two, but I have an eight-year-old, and so she kind of chose something she wanted to do, and so we put her in piano. And, you know, we've got school, but our main focus is the family. And so we, you know, I work full time and yet we always are having sit down meals as often as we can and, you know, going for walks and doing the family sort of things that I feel are important. And then just recently I ran into another parent of a daughter the same age as mine who happens, you know, they come from a two-parent household, and she started asking me what all I had my daughter in, and I was like, well, we just are doing the piano. And, you know, I said, well, we did some baseball over the summer, but nothing, you know, we do one thing at a time. And she was explaining how, you know, she had her daughter in figure skating and ballet and piano lessons and all these things. And I walked away from the conversation feeling like, gee, not only am I a single mom, but I don't have my daughter and all of these things. I must be a really bad mom, too. And it's just, it's so competitive between other parents, and you have to, it becomes very hard as a parent even to decide if, you know, you're not putting your child in everything is somehow, you know, going to make them less, you know, of a desirable student, or if it's not going to give them the drive they need, or if you're actually doing them a good thing. And so hearing your conversation today has actually made me feel like I'm doing a good job.
Well, I think that you were telling us exactly how you were exposed to the hyper-parenting pressure, that you suddenly feel that not enrolling your daughters in all these activities makes you a hair's breadth shy of a child abuser.
Right.
It just isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
If you, as far as I know, and as far as all the information I know, historically and contemporarily, is the one most critical thing for a child is their relationship. And we know, being a single parent, we have to do the job of two. It's so much harder. So as your child gets older, will she enroll in more activities? Maybe. But if she chooses to do so, she feels like the author of her own life, rather than that you chose a script for her to follow. Furthermore, you know, this mom who's enrolling her kid in every activity, it's sort of like, how are we responding to this pressure and doing this and then telling our kids to just say no to poisonous temptations?
Yeah.
Isn't it our job as parents to say, that's a great idea, that's a great idea. No, that's too much. Mm-hmm. But I want to. It's too much. You got to choose. You can do A and B or A and C or A and D, but you can't do A, B, C, and D. It's too much.
Well, it was funny because last night as we were watching the Olympics, when you were talking about the Olympics earlier, she told me that she wanted to be an Olympic swimmer when she grew up. And I got caught between wanting to say, yeah, well, we don't have a swim team anywhere near us, and then explaining to her all of the things you need to do to be an Olympic swimmer, and I kind of, as I started and we had this conversation, I just kind of let it go because I'm like, well, this week she wants to be an Olympic swimmer. I don't need to pop that bubble. But it's funny how the Olympics all of a sudden brings that on, too. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Wendy, for the call. Elizabeth is next from Fish Creek. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Well, I'm a homeschool mom of five kids, and I feel like the individual constitution of each of my children is everything. I have an older child who enrolled in a rigorous program at 16 and has completed it at 19 and had absolutely no problems meeting all of the schedules and timelines and demands and you know, did everything exactly as required in that kind of environment. But I have a 17-year-old son who is very much self-driven, and he tried taking two classes at the local high school, and it went abominably. He was hypercritical and intolerant of jumping through any hoops, and he's exceptionally articulate and very well educated, but I'm concerned that he may not be a person who can move into a college environment because of his unwillingness to just do some things that you have to do, even if it feels banal.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but I think that what you have is every homeschooled situation, every child is different. As I said before, I think many of the homeschooled, I thought most, had solved the problem of socialization and of really getting along with other kids, because being at home only does give you certain social problems. As I read the information, I haven't read every bit of it, the homeschool kids actually do better in college. I don't know what you say about a kid who can't say, all right, I don't like it, but I got to do it. I don't think that's homeschool versus not homeschooled. I think that's a character trait that may be worth looking at and attending to, because it gets you in trouble in life whether you went to public school, private school, or homeschooled.
And thanks so much for the call. We are plumb out of time. Dr. Rosenfeld, thank you so much for being with us. It was
a
really
interesting
hour. Dr. Alvin Rosenfeld is co-author of Hyperparenting: Are You Hurting Your Child by Trying Too Hard? He's also author of The Overscheduled Child, and he's written a number of professional articles, hundreds of professional articles, has received a number of awards, and was in the early 70s while at Harvard among the first clinicians to uncover the high prevalence of sexual abuse among children who became psychiatric patients. He joined the Stanford University Medical School's faculty, heading the Child Psychiatry Training Program, and has been a contributor over the years to our thinking about sexual rearing styles and normal sexual development. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thank you, everybody, for all of your calls and your interest in this pretty engaging topic. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Many more hours of interesting conversation ahead, so stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.